Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody,
yes,
got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care.
Well, good evening and welcome to Lenny Godfrey's Straight No Chaser. What an evening we are going to have this evening. I have two people on the line. First, we were going to have one, but we've got two for you. And it's going to be a very interesting evening. But before we get to that, I want to make sure that you all are comfortable about where you are and how to call in if you have any questions and how to research this. If this is archived, this will be archived, and how for you to reach it if you want to listen to it again. So let's start off with where we are. We're on blogtalkradio.com/ S as in Sam, F as in Fred, T as in Tom, H as in Harry, and the number 2. Knowing those last four or five things, those last four letters and one number, takes you specifically to Lenny Godfrey Straight No Chaser. If you just go to blogtalkradio.com, then you have to search for me. But remember, it's /, S is in Sam, F is in Fred, T is in Tom, H is in Harry, and the number 2. That will get you to Lenny Godfrey Straight No Chaser. Now, the second thing is that here we are in Lenny Godfrey Straight No Chaser, and if you want to call in, and if you want to say hello, ask a question of the guests tonight, ask a question of me, you dial in this very familiar number, 516-453-6063. But then you must press the number 1 if you want to be on air. So with that all said, and now that our housekeeping has been done, I'm about to introduce you to two people who I think are extraordinary. I will start with the female part of the relationship, and then I'll go to the male part of the relationship, and then I will leave it up to them as to who's going to say hello first. Let me tell you about Miss Susan Zita. Well, I'm going to read this because, you know, I couldn't make this up any better than this. But these are things I'd like you to know. She has been recognized nationally and internationally as one of the nation's leading playwrights for family audiences. Her plays have been performed in all 50 states, Canada, Great Britain, Germany, Japan, Korea, Israel, Australia, and New Zealand. I'm going to let her talk about all the awards that she's had, but she is a 6-time winner of the Distinguished Play Award given by the American Alliance of Theater and Education. Now, let me tell you about her as a writer. I will say to you, she has a play, she has many plays, but she has a play called When She Had Wings, and I have had the pleasure of reading this wonderful play that gives an interpretation of a piece of our history through the eyes of a child. And it is absolutely wonderful. I'm going to let Susan tell you about it, but I'm going to tell you, if anyway you see a copy of this, please pick it up. If you have children, if you are a teacher and you want to really delve into something that's beautiful in our education system with children, I suggest that you do this. But enough of shameless plugging. Let me go on. In 2013, Susan retired from the University of Texas, where she had led the playwriting directing program for over 23 years. And as president of the Board of Trustees of the Children's Theater Foundation of America, this organization is one that provides grants to artists and bestows awards and funds collaborative activities in the field of theater for young audiences. I can't tell you how really proud I am to know this woman and to have really starting to make a relationship with her. And we met through a mutual friend, our friend Patricia B. Schneider, but we'll talk about Patricia a little bit later in the program. But now the other half of the partnership, and believe me, they have endured some personal challenges and have really come to be on this show today, and I can't thank them enough. And it is because of their relationship and her husband, Mr. Jim Hancock, who I believe is the steering partner of this whole organization to get them to and fro and about. But he is a director, and he's a movement specialist. One of the things that I'm going to ask him about, it says that he's a Master Alexander Technique teacher. I have no idea what that means, and he is going to explain to me today what a Master Alexander Technique teacher does. He's also an expert in stage combat and, now I'm going to say this and I'm going to kill it, but I'm going to try to say it right. Feldenkrais movement. Now,
that's it. You got it, girl.
I came close. So here they are, everyone. Here is Susan Zeta and her husband, Jim Hancock. Say hello, both of you, please.
Hello.
Nice to be here.
We are so delighted to be here with you all together.
This is going to be fun.
Oh, yes. You know, first of all, let me thank you so much. Because without saying too much of anything, I know what you all, the experience that you all have gone through to get here and what you have ahead of you. And I thank you for making me a part of this environment that you're in. Now I want to share some of the things that I don't know about with the audience, because I'm going to ask you a series of questions that fill up a lot of the gaps that I have about you. So, Susan, what I want to know is tell me where you were born and what that childhood was like with the parents and if the arts influenced you. And while she's telling me, Jim, you think, because that's the same question you're going to answer.
And I'm, oh, my word.
All righty. Okay. First of all, we are so happy here, and this is a wonderful question, because I actually was born in Los Angeles, but left there before I had any memory at all of anything, and spent most of my youth in Greenwich, Connecticut. And when I was 5 years old, my mom gave me the option of either having a birthday party or going to New York with her to see a Broadway show. Now, you know, when you're 5 years old, that birthday party is pretty appealing. You know,
you're so right.
Whatever, you know it. But for some reason, I said, let's go to the theater. And I never, ever had I never had a birthday party after that, because we always went to the theater. So I started going into New York to the theater when I was 5. When I was 8, I had my own subscription to Variety. When I was 13, I was given permission to take the train in and go by myself. And so this early theater experience for me just imprinted me. And I will remember being 5 years old, sitting in the Lintfontein Theater and watching Ethel Merman. And I knew at that moment that my life was going to have something to do with theater from that time forth. And Jim and I have just, day before yesterday, come back from New York, where we revisited some of those old haunts. So I was really fortunate to grow up in a family that prized theater, knew theater, and exposed me very early. And now for the opposite of that story, Mr. Jim.
Oh, but before you go, I have to ask one question. One question, Jim, before you start. What do you, you said it was Ethel Merman. Do you remember what the show was?
Honey, I can sing you every song from it. It was Happy Hunting. It starred Ethel Merman and Fernando Lamas. It had a live force on stage. And I can now, all these years later, still sing every single song from that show. And I have a terrible voice, but an excellent memory.
That's wonderful. All right. Now, Jim, on to you. Tell me your life.
Well, mine is not near as glamorous as Susan's. But I can remember my first theater experience being on stage when I was five and having one line. And the line I remember to this day, what is a four-letter word meaning potato?
Stud.
And you got it. And I think that line was from I Remember Mama. Now, I'm going to fill in a few details that Jim's probably too modest to tell you. Jim grew up on the opposite end of the economic spectrum than I did. When Jim was about eight, he was picking cotton in the fields with his family. His
Where was this?
West Texas. We just drove through it today. We just drove through West Texas, Amarillo, Leah Lake, et cetera. He had a one-building schoolhouse where two grades were in the same room back-to-back. And a totally different kind of upbringing than I had. While I was going, quite frankly, when I was going into New York to see theater on Broadway, Jim was in a field picking cotton. No, well, actually a few years earlier. I know. Because Jim's a little bit older than I am. Not so very much. But.
So now you all, your childhood were very, very different. It reminds me of my relationship with my husband. My childhood was very different from his. His was very similar to yours, Jim. And mine was a bit similar to yours, Susan. I went to private school and all those things. So it's an interesting how childhoods can really attract people. So I'm going to, all right, so now I've got you just about, you when you were 13, Susan, you were given permission to go on the train. Now you're beginning to enter into the teenage years and high school, middle school, high school, and then going on to college. When did you think you started thinking about art as a serious, not vocation, but as a serious consideration for something that you'd like to do in your life?
Quite frankly, when I was five, I always knew that I was going to have something to do with it. I actually thought I was going to be a big, brassy Broadway star, but I can't sing and I can't dance. And then finding the fact that I could write and that I'm a playwright, that was really when I found that was what I could do. But there was something about those early childhood theater experiences that imprinted me so deeply, because the degree of passion, the degree of commitment, the degree of wonder that a child finds in the theater is something that has never left me. And that, quite frankly, Lenny, is why most of my career has been devoted to writing for, with, and about young people who had the same kind of galvanic theater experience that I had.
Now, when did you think in your life, now listen to these questions, Jim, because they're coming back at you. So when did you think in your life, did you find that was writing was going to be the craft that would keep you in the arts for the rest of your life? When did that happen? When was that discovered?
Well, that really happened, I think, when I was in college. Because when I was in high school, I was in all the high school plays. I usually played the bossy best friend or the loudmouth aunt or, you know, all the character roles. And I think somewhere it also dawned on me that if I were to stay as an actress, I would be limited to those kinds of personas, those kinds of characters, that kind of outlet. And I had more voices in me than that. And I had a wonderful, wonderful gifted teacher when I was in my first, really first 2 years of college that quite frankly sat me down. I was actually in a show she was directing. And she said, you know what? I don't think you're an actress, but I really think you're a writer. And that was the greatest gift I could have been given.
You see? It is important when people see things in you. I think that, you know, there are a lot of similarities that we have in life. And it is about, for me also, it was about time in college that made that difference. Now, what
right.
about you, Jim? When did it hit you? Now, you are a director and you have all of these other special talents that you have that you're going to explain to me so that I can pronounce them eventually.
I will have a difficult time explaining all of my experiences, but I can tell you one of the things that interested me most when I was probably in the fifth grade or so was I was a skinny child and I admired jocks who were really buffed up and meeting girls, etc. And I wanted to be one of them, but I wasn't. But I could sing, I could dance, I could memorize lines, and I could read and write. And I was the teacher's pet because of that, because I could read. And I was often the person who could recite things in the class. But I still didn't know how to meet girls. So I decided I'm going to try out for every show that comes along, and I'm going to get in the bloody things. And so that was the way I began my career. It was hardly exceptional like Susan was.
Oh, my God. That's the first time I ever heard that story. His whole career is due to hormones.
I'm telling you, I have people who have come on here, and they have told things on this radio program that they have never told anybody. Like they were telling somebody in a secret. I said, do you realize there are a lot of people who are now have heard this story about you? Well, that's absolutely fabulous. You know,
now it's known.
Do you remember?
My teachers.
Go ahead, please, Jim.
Well, my teachers later, when I had a reunion, I think when I was, 40 or 50 or something like that. And still some of my teachers were around. And when they saw me, they said, oh, my God, we thought you were going to be a movie star. And I said, I turned out to be a teacher. And it was to your effect. So that was a good ground.
Both of you are educated in that way. Susan, let me ask you, do you remember the first thing that you wrote?
Oh, yeah, I sure do. I do. And actually, it came from a whole lie. It was just crazy. I went to a small college in upstate New York, and we used to tour every year. And Jim's just choking on his past at the moment. Okay. And we were all supposed to go and audition, but we toured. We actually took a tour show out. And I got behind and I said to my scene partner, we just hadn't rehearsed enough. So I went into my teacher and I said, a total lie. I said, the reason why we're not prepared is I'm writing a play. And she said, really? And I said, yes, and I just need another day or 48 hours to get it into you. And so she said, okay, wonderful. And you know, so then my scene partner and I got our audition together and we walked in and were ready to audition. And my scene partner said, Susan, what are you going to say to Miss Olson when you actually have to confess that you didn't write a play? I thought, okay. So I went and I wrote a really fast, really terrible play that was based on a novel I was reading in school. And so I brought it in, and Sarah, my scene partner, was on the other side of the wall, all ready to go. And my teacher looked at it, and she said, She said, well, it's not very good. And I knew that because I was ready to say, okay, now let us show you our audition. And she said, but it has a beginning, middle, and an end. It has an arc of action. It has two characters that have different voices. And I was going, really? 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 And an hour later, when my scene partner knocked on the door, my teacher had said, we're going to do this play on tour, but you're going to rewrite like crazy. And so it all started as something I never anticipated, but I just fell backwards into the arms of the rest of my life.
Isn't that interesting? What about you, Jim? Was it purposeful? You know, I know that you got into it so you could meet women. Now, we got that out the way.
Sorry about that.
No, that's wonderful. But the first time when beyond that, it became something that you realized this was something that you really wanted to do for your vocation. Well, do you remember kind of when that struck you?
Yes, I can. One of the things that really happened to me is that I could express my emotions, and I felt like I couldn't do that in the classroom or in other instances within the academic world. But I had characters that had lives that I could pretend were mine. And it was a pretension because I grew up very alone, and I felt like that I didn't have the opportunity to express myself as I wanted to, and I could express them through characters. And so I began to really love that idea of taking someone on and recreating a life that made sense to me.
Hello, are we still there?
Yes,
connected.
Yes.
Oh, good, good, good. Jim, he got the phone a little too close to the ear. You almost hung us up. So go.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. My ear got in the way. Well, my mind gets in the way most of the time. So, any case, I really felt like the stage seemed to call me because I had no idea what theater was. We had performances. We had things that school projects that we did. But I didn't get into that until I was in my 20s. And then I saw my professional show, and I thought, oh, my God, that's what it's about. Oh, Jesus,
yeah.
What have I been doing? And then I decided I better learn how to do this because there's a passion there that I can't get any other place. And so I began to study and began to do more productions and began to sing and took on tours with singing. And so that's the way it began and the way it expanded into what I ultimately did was to become a teacher of theater and acting, et cetera. So it's been a long journey, but one that has been instilled in great appreciation.
Sounds wonderful. How, you know, both of you are teachers. So how did you two meet coming from so many
schools?
I'm going to give Jim a little other plug right in here, and then we will tell you the real story. Jim was an early student, actually, of Tyrone Guthrie. Jim did his PhD work. Yep, he did his PhD work in Minnesota. He had just come off of a very long tour as the entertainment director in Southeast Asia. So he'd been putting together just right after the Korean War and had been putting together tours and troops and directing little plays, et cetera, and just on a wild lark applied to the directing program, the first directing program at University of Minnesota under Tyrone Guthrie, and was astonished when he got in. So that was where I met Jim was when we talk about both being teachers. Jim was my teacher, and I was a graduate student at SMU, and Jim had been a very, very influential member of starting the graduate acting program at SMU, which is sort of a legendary actor training program. And he had only been there about 2 years, and I came in as a grad student in playwriting. And so Jim was my teacher. Now, we didn't actually get together as anything other than teacher and student for several years after my graduation. I want to put that in right now. But Jim was my teacher then, and Jim continues to be my teacher every day of my life.
Oh, isn't that wonderful? Now, so Jim, when did you decide that she was not going to be the student anymore and she was going to be the lady of your life?
Oh, you asked the best questions in the world.
Thank you. I know that my audience is saying the same thing. Like, so how did you all, what happened here? So tell the story.
Well, what happened? Well, okay, here's a story that really did happen. Susan, it's time for grades. You know, when you're in academia, you have grades, but classes you do. So Susan came in. She had been in one of my classes, and so she came in and she got a B. And she said, "Mr. Hancock, I think maybe you made a mistake. I want to know why I got it."
I'm going to grab it for a minute. I was a very bad student in high school. I was a very good student in college, and I knew what it took to get an A, and I absolutely thought I did it in that class. But when Jim gave me a B, I absolutely knew it was a mistake. Go.
Well, she came into my office and said, "I think you made a mistake." And I said, "Why do you think so?" She said, "Because you gave me a B." I said, "Well, you read my syllabus, and my syllabus says that you have to do the best work that you're capable of doing. And do you believe you did that?" And she said, "Yes, I do." I said, "Well, obviously, we have different opinions."
No, actually, I'm going to rewrite that statement, because actually what he said was, "Obviously, I have a higher opinion of that than you do." Now, can you imagine? No. Can you imagine being told by someone you respect so much, "I have a higher opinion of what you can do than you do"? And I thought, I love this man. Now, this interview is going in a really different direction.
You got to be careful here.
So, no, that was absolutely the truth. So, now, we're going to skip forward a lot of years, and Jim and I are both teaching now at University of Texas, and he has the very star acting student in the program there, and Jim had given him a B because he did very adequate work and very good work, but not the best work he was capable of doing. And this young man came up to Jim's office and said, "Jim, I think you made a mistake." And Jim, before he even went any further, he sat down and talked to Susan. And so I hear this little knock, knock, knock on my door. And Joe, his name was, came in and said, "For some reason, Jim told me I had to come talk to you." And I said, "My darling, you got to be. Sit down." And what it meant was, this is the kind of inspiration that the teacher can give you that is both an assessment of where you are and a hope and a vision of where you can become that inspires you truly to do your best work.
Now, well, let me finish the story.
Okay, go ahead. Finish the story.
All right. At the end of that semester, this was his last year as a graduate student. At the end of the semester, he came back into my office and knocked on the door and said, "I just wanted to say goodbye to you and thank you for my work." And I said, "Thank you. I think you did very good work." And so he started to leave, and I said, "Wait a minute. Don't you want to know what grade you made?" And he said, "No, I know what I did."
Really?
The greatest gift a teacher can give a student is the knowledge of their own power.
Of their own worth. And yes.
And their own
worth.
Absolutely.
Yes, their worth. You know, I had a teacher in college that did the same thing to me. I thought, well, no, the evaluation was, tell me what you think you deserve. And I knew I was an A student, but I thought I was going to be modest. And so I thought, I'm going to put down B. Well, my lesson was this. you two. You better put down what you think you deserve for the rest of your life. It was Audrey Moon, who was the artistic director of the Billie Holiday Theater in New York for 40-some years, was my teacher when I went away from school. I went away to school, to private school, to Hampton University, and who discovered that I should be in the theater. But she didn't. She said, oh, no, if you don't think that you're good, then I'm not going to push you. You have to think that you're good. You know you deserve that. You should have said it. And believe me, that was the worst thing she taught me, because she's created a Frankenstein. Baby, I will tell you in a minute. No, I am fierce. I don't want anything.
No, that's not a Frankenstein. No, that's fabulous.
That's fabulous.
Well, but you know, but I
love that.
It's so interesting how teachers can really be so influential for you, because I went on from there to go back to New York. And then started my studying under Lloyd Richards at that point at Hunter College. Had she not been so instrumental to say, this is what you must not know your worth, and if this is not what you want to do, I mean, I tell her to this day, thank you, thank you, thank you, all the time. Because I don't really think that she understands what she did for me. And I wanted to be a teacher, and I love these stories about teachers. All of my good friends are teachers and principals, because we all studied together, and I thought I was going to be a teacher. And look at this. You all have brought together for this particular program the marriage of education and the arts. You know, I guess people were saying, well, now, Lenny, are you ever going to get back to the arts? Because, I mean, it's wonderful hearing their story, but we need what you've just said was how you married not only physically, but also symbolically the arts.
Yeah.
And in partnership with education. You know, one of the things, Susan, I do want
Well said.
Thank you. Want people to know is that how we really got to know one another. And that is because when we said we were going to talk about Patricia for a little bit. Patricia came up to me. Patricia has been very, very instrumental in my life as allowing me to be a performer in roles that were not traditionally given to women who are Black Americans, who are Black, period, allowing me to direct in her theater, and also has been inspirational to this very day to the things that she thinks that I'm capable of. Well, one of the things that she thought I was capable of was having a nice voice and that voice, to contribute that voice to your organization, one of the organizations that you had after school, and that was the Children's Theater Foundation of America. And having the opportunity to meet you, and I want you to talk about the children's, you know, CTFA. I want you to talk about it for a little bit. You're at the helm of it.
Sure.
You know,
yes,
and I want people to understand, you know, the importance of education that we plan it for our children and letting our children be children for a little while. They've been robbed of their childhood so much. So talk about it a little bit, Susan. You got to break now.
Before we
don't relax too much.
I told him to sit for a second. Okay, but absolutely. The first thing I want to do is give a shout out really to Patricia and to her wonderful son, Will. Because now I first met Patricia through ACTEJ, which is the International Children's Theater Organization. And Patricia is really a legend in the field of theater for young audiences. The work that she did, what she did as a director, as a producer, and as a spokesperson is emblematic of the very best of what theater for youth in this country is, has been, and can be. And it was wonderful for me to know that I shared a beautiful student of mine, Kathleen Collins, with Patricia when Kathleen was much younger and was under knew Patricia then too. So the contribution that Patricia has made to Theater for Youth cannot be measured. But anyway, I am the board president of the Children's Theater Foundation of America. We are the only foundation in the United States that is devoted exclusively to supporting theater artists and organizations that work with, for, and about children. And we're a tiny little foundation, and we give awards, and we give grants, but we try to give grants at those places, those junctures where theater companies and theater artists are about to make a huge breakthrough for themselves and for their audiences. Working in the field of theater for young audiences, which is what I've done as a playwright all of my life, has been one of the most rewarding experiences I could ever have, because there is the one thing that every audience member will have in common, no matter if you're a parent, a grandparent, a child, a very young child, is that you were once a kid. And mm-hmm. theater can make an impression, can change a perspective, can give introspection into what the lives of kids are about. Children's theater is not all about fairy tales, although some wonderful fairy tales and adaptations of those exist. Children's theater is trying to use the full power of theater and bringing that to bear with the velocity of childhood as a time of wonder and discovery. So mm-hmm. I am so thrilled to be president of this organization that does absolutely nothing but give our little bit of money to artists at a time when they need it the most.
Well, I have to tell you that I was honored to be asked to do narration for it.
I know. I love it. We are doing our very, very, very first in our whole 60-year history video. And Will Severin has given us the great gift of his talent and helping us put it together. We're in draft about 69. And Lenny came in and did the narration. And Lenny, I'm just going to tell you, I just sent Will, I'm going to send Will on Monday the latest draft, which is where, everything's in process. But
exactly.
Lenny's voice just brought the vitality, the charm, the excitement, the dynamism, the depth, and the power.
The brilliance of articulation.
And the brilliance of articulation
thank you.
Video.
Really? Oh, okay.
Absolutely.
Your check is in the mail. Your check is in the mail, both of you. Your check is in
no.
the mail. But, no, really, thank you.
No.
It was my honor.
This is how we met each other.
Yes. You know, and through that relationship, I said one day to Susan, I said, Susan, I think I'd love to have a conversation with you. And you didn't even say, oh, yeah, that's fine. Yeah, okay, fine. I mean, you didn't even blink. You went, okay, yeah, fine. Yeah. One of the things that's so important to me, the reason why I do this, is I don't think that yet in our society do we really understand the importance of the arts and its impact and influence on our lives. And and that impact and influence should start very early. I'm troubled by the fact that our children sometimes don't have art classes. And I mean that. I mean any kind of art class, visual arts. The spoken word, they don't because of budgetary, situations. And I have had such a wonderful life that the arts has given me, that God has given me a great voice to sing, and that's a gift from God. And I really do believe that you give back. And one of the things that I want to do is give back and make people aware that we need to respect the arts a little bit more, all facets of it, whether it's entertainment, mm-hmm. whether it's visual, the written word, the spoken word, and that needs to be a very important component in our lives. You know, they talk about the aspect of math and science and English and all, I say you must put arts in all of those acronyms. And that
absolutely, then.
It's the way to be human.
Yep.
Yes. Yeah, now I'm coming off my soapbox, but I really, you exemplify really what it is that I believe, how the introduction of the arts, it starts with children. You don't have to become an entertainer. You become a patron of the arts, a supporter of the arts. And it becomes a perpetual thing. And this it's how our society really survives. The arts, without the arts, what would one of our days be like? It would be so dull and boring. And we don't even realize we take it for granted. So this is one of my missions and purposes, and I thank you all so much for really exemplifying it in your conversation and really in your journey of how you two met and how the arts really brought you together and cemented your relationship and how you give back every single day. Now, before I go on.
Lenny, you're absolutely right. I got to just build on that for 1 minute, because when you're talking
sure.
about math, science, you know, all the hard things. The one thing, the things that the arts offer is that they teach compassion, they teach understanding, and they teach empathy. Because when a child is sitting in an audience and sees a character who looks like them, who sounds like them, and who gives voice to something that they have felt and known and not known how to deal with, that is that alchemy of the moment. It's the alchemy of time and space and thought and word and music that comes together and is truly life-changing. I think that is why I have devoted my career to writing about kids, because I want to write about survivors who are at a time in their life when their life changes forever and do it on a positive way. And we can do that in the arts. We can do that through theater.
Yes. Absolutely. We just have to be diligent about it. We just have to insist that, yes, the sciences are important. Yes, English is important. Yes, math is important.
Right.
But not anymore. All of those, those subjects have the arts all in them. You know, you learn math when you learn the meter of how to learn a song, the time signature. You know, there's so many things, there's so many components that people don't realize every single day are intertwined with what an education in the arts can do for you. And beyond, you know, a lot of people say, why do I have to take biology? You know, well, you do. You ultimately do understand a little bit more about it as you get older. The same thing goes for the arts, I do believe. The same thing goes for
absolutely.
The arts.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, you know, now, Jim, I'm coming back to you because you have to explain to me what it is that I talked about that you do so that people understand. Also, this is something very important. A movement specialist. What is the Master Alexander technique that you teach? What is that?
Well, it's basically when I teach movement, I teach movement as a way of beginning to experience self, how we have to understand our bodies before we can ever put another character on stage. So my approach to movement is one dealing with the inner source as well as the outer process of the individual. So, and the Alexander technique basically is another way of finding a way to get the body into a place of ease and economy of motion that allows you to access an inner resource. We all have inner resources if we can find a way to access it. And this is a way of accessing it. It's finding the balanced relationship within the body that can reveal what you need and how you can express it and how you can believe in it and work on it. It is not an easy thing to do. It's not fabulous, and it's not, you know, not something for going to the gym and working out and becoming buff. It's more like, who am I? What am I about? What does my body say to me? Because if you listen to your body, the body listens to you, and that is essential to an actor, to an individual, to everyone that it comes into my realm of believability. And I do believe that that's what Alexander's about. That's what any movement approach to life is about. And I have studied most of them, because when I was teaching, I always thought I didn't know enough. I had to know more. So I went out and I searched and I looked at different approaches, and I came back and decided what worked and what didn't work. And so when I felt that I had found the place where there was a balanced relationship of inner source and outer source, and that would allow you to make choices that were important to character, to situation, to life. And if you have that, you can enact anyone on stage.
Yes.
If you don't have that, it's just words. Sorry.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a journey of self-discovery, you know?
Absolutely.
That's exactly right.
Exactly. And many years ago, Jim and I got very envious of the way Jim worked with actors, because he really worked with them as people, finding the depth of themselves, finding their own voice, finding their own movement. And so he and I began teaching together, and we developed an approach that we call Inner Sources for Outward Expression.
Outright expression.
And we wrote a book together, which is now out of publication. But it began to approach creative work from a body-mind approach, starting with the body and then going into how does that physical experience of time and space and tension and release and momentum and velocity make itself manifest in writing. And we have taught together for years and years. We started at Northwestern and then integrated the work into our classes in Texas.
It sounds so, so this brings me to, first of all, let me just say, everyone, I'm saying we have about 8 minutes more of conversation, and then we have to do a little of ending this down. So if you have any questions, this is the time. You know, don't ask me the question the last 3 minutes, because it's going to cut off, you know. So before I go into my
and we're
next
gone.
Yes, and we're gone. You will be able to ask us some questions this time, because we actually are going to do a webinar, and I'm very excited about that. I put the link on Facebook so people can go to the link, and while we're doing that video, they can be a part of it, and they can, in the chat, ask you questions while we're continuing this conversation. But let me say, all of this leads to me, my asking that my one of my final questions, and that is, so what, where are you now? What do you want to do next? You've done so much. You've taught together. You've written a book together. You have separate careers, and you have joint careers. In 5 years, what do you want to see that you've accomplished more than what you're doing now? What would you like the world of arts to be like?
Oh, my God. I guess
What I would like to see of the world coming to being themselves, understanding who they are, how they feel, what they believe in, and how they can express that with great grace. And I think grace is important to understand who you are and how you work.
If we could take the principles that we have both based our lives on, which is humanity, compassion, interaction, talking, and listening, and there's any way that we could project that into the larger environment of the real world, I think that would be good. When you say, what do you want to be in 5 years? I just want to be alive and still doing what I'm doing.
I want to give back. I want to give back what I have really learned in my life, what I have tried to teach in my experience as a teacher, as a performer, as a director. I want to give back what I've learned and hope that the essential of becoming yourself is absolutely first hand and not just a technique or some particular approach. Those are important as far as education is concerned, but the bottom line is that you have to become yourself. You have to know yourself, and that is not psychology. It's reality. It's love. It's love. It's compassion. It's all those things that make us human.
Yeah,
I agree. I totally agree. I totally agree. Well, you know, this has been absolutely a wonderful conversation. First of all, my surprise in including Jim and the added dimension that you bring and to the whole conversation. But both of you, I have to tell you, it is really wonderful to know that there are people in our industry who are so devoted and passionate about being so genuine about the arts. You all both have been very successful in your career. So, you know, commercial success has been really great. But it is, for me, I have the radar to know that it's the passion that drives you and not the commercial part of it.
Exactly right.
You know, I think, Lindy, what we're looking for, we just got back from New York. It was a very big birthday for Jim, this birthday. We don't necessarily need to go into numbers, but 91 is one that might float by. But was a really important birthday to go back to New York, to go back to where I started in theater going, you know, as a kid. And I got to tell you what we found. We found what we didn't expect, kindness everywhere, kindness and passion and compassion. And so sometimes New York City gets a bad rap, but every single person we encountered came from a kind and a compassionate and an excited. I tell you, we saw 3 Broadway shows in the last week. Every one of them was packed. Every one of them was joyous. Every one of them had audiences cheering. So we've got to take both the velocity and the energy of the arts and of theater and inject it into the rest of our society.
And it's projection of our lives.
Yep.
Yes.
And to
how we live.
The currency of the future has got to be kindness or we're all doomed.
Isn't that interesting?
Loving kindness.
Yes, yes.
Loving.
You know, yes. Do you all think that you're going to write another book? Or
I don't know. I don't know. We might.
We want to talk to people like you.
Well, you know, I mean, I would love to be able to, you know, what you just said, to be able to expound upon that and read how to achieve that in our society, what your opinion of that might be. I'm always interested in people who really see the positive of where we're going. There's so many negative things that are happening in our industry and in the world in general. And to hear someone to say, no, we must move forward. There are many, many things in our business that, you know, will move us forward. Some things are going to stay traditionally. Some things are going to change. But to be open to change and to be open to the things that can enhance it so that we have longevity. Our business is one that sometimes it can be a little bit elitist. And we need to be able to, you know, we want to open it up so everyone can enjoy all of the arts in a lot of this. You know, that's one of the things that concerns me. And I always want to ask the lotto to guide children. And my answer is that I will guide your child if economically I would rather guide a child that has no money than one who has access and can all of the help that they need. I'm not helping you. I want to help somebody. I really, because you'll be able to get anybody to help you. But the child who does not, as we use this word, Susan, and I'm going to say, the child that is voiceless. That's powerless. Those are the.
That's right.
Those are the ones that I think that we need to reach out to and make sure that they have an equal footing with everyone else that's in their peer group.
And that's one of the things that the CTFA, the Children's Theatre Foundation of America, is absolutely devoted to. And one of the pledges that we made about 4 years ago is that we are looking at projects, at programs that actively engage and attempt to deal with both structural and institutional racism in our society. And so the projects that we fund, the shows that the artists that we're investing in are the ones that are saying, let us look to a different way of dealing with the tensions and the dichotomies and the polarities of our society and trying to find a way. I'm going to go back to a word you used early, healing. How
yes.
can the arts be a force to heal what is broken, not just in our society, but our souls? And if we can heal that one person at a time, even a little, then our artistic expression will represent that.
And behind that is the key word, awareness. We have
yes.
to be aware of
yes.
everything we think, we do, we believe in, and process it.
Yes. Well, I'm going to take this opportunity to kind of put us on pause because we're going to continue and this on our webinar, which starts in about 5 minutes because I have now gotten a notice of it. This is all so exciting. So I'm going to this for you all to take a breath and refresh yourselves while I set up the webinar, while I explain to my audience, please go to Facebook, please look at the link and click on the link and join us and as we videotape this webinar and hopefully as I also have it live on YouTube. So,
great.
With that,
so Lenny, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for this program. Thank you for what you do.
Thank you. Thank you for coming on and being so wonderful, the two of you. But we're not finished, so I'm not going to say goodbye. I'm just going to say take a breath, and I'll see you
okay.
After the link, you know, activate.
See
okay. All right.
See
everyone,
you in a minute. Now, Lenny, right. do I hang up the phone? I hang up the phone now, right?
Yes, you may hang up the phone now. I'm going to just end the program. Yep, you may. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much. You can see that this has been an absolute wonderful opportunity to really hear about the arts from people who are quite passionate about it. And so I'm looking forward to next week. I'm going to be having a conversation with a wonderful writer and entrepreneur. His name is Abdul Ali, and he's going to talk about many things that he's been doing. And I met him years ago when he was a student and interviewing me when I was doing Gem of the Ocean. So that's going to be next week, and we're going to continue to do the webinar next week. So look for the link, and there'll be a recurring link that you can do and save. So right now, we'll see you. This time, I'm going to see you in the video. Those of you, you'll see us as we're doing it. So thank you so very much for tuning in. And I will see you next week on the radio. Lenny Godfrey, straight, no chaser.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love.